caregivers and support groups. I'm going to ask Paul Falkowski to come in just a moment to say something about a network for caregivers that Paul and Marilyn are establishing. I also want to recognize Joe. Would you stand? Joe over here is into laughter therapy at the moment. Joe, would you stand just for a moment? Joe is a therapist down at the University Med Center. Also runs, is involved in the Pain Management Center down there, and is involved in some support groups for people in chronic pain. So if that interests you, do see Joe. I'm sure you'd be happy, Joe, to talk to folks about this. Nice to have you here. And then one or two folks have asked if we have a support group here in Trinity for those with chronic pain. We don't at this point, but if on your response sheet you'd like to indicate that that would interest you, then we can see whether we should be doing anything locally right here along those lines. Okay, Paul, if you just come and share, please.
Well, good morning, and my name is Paul Falkowski, and 3 years ago or so, the Lord sent Mary and I on a journey into nursing homes and care facilities for the mentally retarded, psychiatric units for adolescent children, and he began to teach us many of the things that you're hearing this morning being presented and during this conference. Our society has taught us some very wrong things. Beauty is something that we see on the exterior, and that wealth is something that you carry in your pocket. What we've learned is quite the opposite, and we've met some very beautiful people who are very ill, very twisted. The Lord has shown us how to see their heart and to hear not the voice of pain or blurred language, but to hear the voice of one who loves and is loved by the Lord. We're very excited. I'm very excited about this conference because I believe that God is beginning to talk to a lot of people in His body about caring for people who cannot care for themselves. And this conference is focusing on the one I believe that needs care. And what we are putting together and have in place is a ministry for the people who are giving the care in their home, and we call them caregivers. And they're all over Omaha, they're all over the United States. And many of the issues and topics that are being discussed here are almost and directly transferable to the caregiver. For example, feelings of guilt, or being isolated and being lonely, resentment and anger. You know that if you are a professional caregiver, you've been trained and gone through a lot of training to know how to give that care. But if you're the daughter of a mother who now has Alzheimer's, you may not have had the advantage of being able to go to school to learn. And you're learning the hard way. And you have feelings that you didn't think you would have. You begin to feel isolated and lonely and even overwhelmed. So what we have put together in Desert Ministries this year is a group called Christian Caregivers. And Christian Caregivers has actually been in place for about a year. But our mission, our vision is so similar that we put the two ministries together. And so we're not only going into these facilities, but we want to go into people's homes and provide support. And we want to be a resource for those of you who are caregivers. You might wonder, am I a caregiver? If you are providing some form of financial assistance, if you offer emotional support, if you are doing the daily living assistant kinds of things, bathing and dressing, are you trying to deal with someone who lives in another town? I know my mother lives in Clearwater, Florida, and it's very frustrating to try to get things done over the phone sometimes. And are you trying to meet the needs of a loved one who does live in a care facility, like a nursing home? You too are a caregiver. How many of you feel like you fit that description? Quite a few of you. So this is the other side of the coin, so to speak. How many of you would like to see a conference for caregivers? That's something that I think that we should look at. I have a pamphlet I hope that you will all pick up. If you would like to get one right now, I think Mary would be happy if you want to raise your hand and Mary could get you a pamphlet about Christian caregivers. I think that's mainly what I want to say. Right now, we meet the second Saturday of each month, and Marilyn Doolittle, are you here, Marilyn? Can you stand up just so everybody can see you? Marilyn Doolittle heads that meeting up the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11:30 at the Royal Oaks Care Center, which is north of the Norwest Bank on 52nd Street. And if you need more information, the number is 572-0861. It's in this pamphlet. One of the things that I think is so important as we deal with this whole issue is that we learn that we can support each other, not just with the practical needs and resources, transportation, that kinds of things, but we come for prayer, we come for biblical understanding, and we seek God in this whole issue, offer words of encouragement and follow-up on a day-to-day basis as we move through this. Anyway, I'm very excited about this whole thing, and I just thank you for this time, Ray, that you've allowed me to stand up and speak. And if you have any more questions, please see Marilyn or see myself, and we'll be glad to fill you in on what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's thank Paul for his wonderful music as well. Just two things again on the caregivers. There are specific small groups for caregivers, and we've tried to put you into appropriate groups. And then this afternoon, when we have prayer ministry, do feel that is for you if you're a caregiver, because sometimes caregivers carry enormously heavy loads, and we would like to pray for you and to bless you in your ministry and into your life. So don't feel it is just for those who have illnesses, but that prayer ministry is also designed for you. What we'd like to do in this session up until 11:30 is we'd like to go back where we were last night in dealing with some very, very practical issues. And so this is a hands-on session where you can interact from the floor and ask questions and respond to what is being said. We want you to do that. Last night we covered two areas. One was marriage, and the other was caregiving. This morning, we've got two or three or four or five, depending on how far we get. And the first I'd like to pick up on this morning is the important area of our relationship with physicians. As those who are chronically ill or supporting those who are chronically ill, some of you have seen many, many physicians over the years. And people ask me, you know, sometimes people have a life verse. You know, people say, what is your, you know, life verse? And I've often thought of responding, you know, with the verse, you know, of the woman who had been ill for 17 years and spent all her money on physicians and got worse rather than better. But that's a little cruel and unkind. And just for Mark sitting on the front row here, he's got things to throw at me, you see, if I get too out of order at this point. But I want to run through a few things. One or two of them are negative, one or two are positive. And then I want you to respond, and I'd like you to respond, Mark, as a physician as well. It's very important. Let me just give you a quote from a physician. He says, as you're probably aware, we medical doctors are fascinated by technology. It's unfortunate, but our training tends to leave us more comfortable with machinery than with people. So it is that we tend to feel shaky with patients until we can pull a frame of words and numbers around them. This predisposition damages our own humanity and limits our ability to heal as much as it degrades our patients. So for your sake and for ours, please keep reminding us how important you are. Okay. Four or five things I'll say, and then you can respond. Number one, when you go to a physician, number one, they don't have a machine to measure your pain. There are no pain meters. Now, it took me a long time to realize that when I walk into a physician's office, he doesn't know, whether I'm a linebacker, and I'm complaining about pain, because I can't interact so violently on the football field, or, whether I've, had pain, for 25 years, and it's difficult for me to get out of bed. And so there's this enormous spectrum, and you walk in their door, and very, very quickly, they have to start making assessments. And so be courteous, be patient. It would be wonderful if they could clamp a meter on you that would measure your pain, but they can't. They can't. They have to draw that out. And so there's an enormous spectrum. And some people, they've got an ingrowing toenail and you'd think they were terminal, This is just, the worst thing. And somebody else is terminal and they're hardly complaining. And so you've got this enormous spectrum. And whenever Jenny now hardly lets me go to the doctor alone, because whenever I go, they say, "How are you?" And I say, "Pretty good, And they say, "Great, I'm so pleased." And Jenny says, "For goodness, tell them how you really are." It's very difficult for me to do that. And so sometimes, if you're on that end where you minimize how you are, sometimes you need a spouse or a friend to speak for you. And that's very important because they don't know, and I'm sure, Joe, you find this again and again, it's very, very hard to know, whether you've got somebody, who's really in trouble or somebody who's simply, making a lot of noise and a lot of complaining, and in fact their complaint is not that great. You may want to come back on that a little later, Joe. So, number one, they don't have a pain meter. Number two, in my experience, physicians respond better to the acute than to the chronic. In other words, it's great, when you go to a physician and you say, "I got this terrible pain, and he examines you and he says, "Oh, you've got to have an operation, this is a hernia or an appendectomy or whatever, or you need a new heart on your valve or whatever," and you go in and you have the operation and you come out and you recover. And they say, "How are you?" You say, "Fantastic, I feel so much better." And you feel good, and they feel good, and you feel good, and they feel good. And they smile, and you smile, and you pay the bill, and they accept it. And it's all great and wonderful. And just is such a good relationship. But when you go back after the operation or after treatment, and they say, "How are you?" And you say, "I'm no better." You don't smile and they don't smile, okay? And then you come back again and you say, "How are you?" And I always want to say a little bit better, even if I'm not, somehow you want to respond. You don't want to mess up the relationship and be a complainer and and always I stretch it. If I can say even a little bit, I'll try and say it, because you don't like going back and saying, "Hasn't worked, I don't feel any better." He doesn't like it, you don't like it, and it is difficult. And most physicians, they respond much more positively to the acute. It's quickly down, quickly up, you're better, away, great. When it drags on, it's much more difficult for them and for you. And I think the most difficult thing for my surgeon in London, who I've known for many, many years, he looked at me one day and he said, "I have to tell you, there's nothing more I can do, And he didn't want to say that. I knew he didn't want to say that, And I didn't want to hear that. And it becomes difficult. And as I said last night, often the focus, rightly so, in medicine has been on cure, kind of fix-it mentality, and sometimes can be a little bit short on care. We can't fix it, but we're going to care for you. And there are, I think, many things afoot to redress that balance in the medical world. And I haven't acknowledged Doug at the back here as well, also in medicine, and you respond to us as well. If we complain too much about you, you throw things as well at us. Number three, and I said this last night, accept their diagnosis, but don't necessarily accept their prognosis. In many cases, they've got to give you the worst case scenario because of, the threat of litigation, and they didn't do and say all they could have done and said, and so they've got to empty out on you. got to empty out on you. And so accept their diagnosis, not necessarily their prognosis, because we believe that's in the hands of God, and the Holy Spirit can give life to our mortal bodies, and our lives are in the hands of God. And so that's very important. Number four, find a physician who will listen. Find a physician who will listen. And as I said yesterday, they are paid more for procedures, okay, than they are for listening. They're paid more to stitch your hand than they are to hold your hand. And just another quote here that I find regrettably true in my experience. Somebody said, the success of a physician's work will often depend on the acuity with which he or she can hear the fragmentary language of pain, coax it into clarity, and interpret it. Yet the experience of many people with the medical community would bear out the opposite conclusions, that physicians do not trust the human voice, that they in effect perceive the voice of the patient as an unreliable narrator of bodily events, a voice which must be bypassed as quickly as possible so that they can get around and behind it to the physical events themselves. Now, thank God that's not been true of all physicians that I've come in contact with, but often there does seem to be an impatience with you, okay, and sometimes a distrust of you, and a wanting to hook you up to a machine rather than allow you to tell your story as it is. And so that's simply because they've had training as well, and sometimes their training is not necessarily so care-oriented. And we need to recognize that and find physicians who can help us in that way. I should say, and Joe mentioned this to me last night, that of course another thing that militates against the care of the chronically ill is insurance companies want to settle. You know, they don't want ongoing chronic cases. Okay, and so then again there's some tension often with you as a person with a chronic illness, because even the system is more designed to, you know, pay for the acute and the case is opened and closed rather than something that's going on through time. Number five, and this is very, very important, their words are disproportionately influential in our lives. Now, many people, you know, the doctor said is virtually God said, you know. And we've grown up in a culture where what the doctor says, well, you just do what the doctor says. And what we have to realize is that they're doing their best. They've been educated as much as they can. They're giving judgments as clearly as they... But the doctor said, okay, is still often their best evaluation with the data they have. It need not be right. It could be wrong. And so what I'm saying, and now many doctors will not say, you've probably got 6 months to live, or you'll probably not walk again. And the reason they won't say it is it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because the doctor said I'd be dead in 6 months, so I might as well die. I mean, he said it. And that's why many of them will be much more cautious now, much more cautious in telling you what's going to happen, because they've realized that their words carry enormous weights in our lives. And we have to realize that they too are men and women doing their best with the data that they have, their training and their background, but the doctor says is not equal to what might happen. And so we need to, by all means, respect them, listen to their advice, but you know, we mustn't let it be waiting beyond what they would want it to be. And I'm sure that Mark and Dan would agree to that point. You know, you are men, aren't you? You know, you're just checking. You're not gods, so you know, whatever. You can ask Mark's wife if you really want to know, and get the inside track there. Number six, just a couple more quickly here. They are not the primary managers of your healthcare. You are. Let me say that again. They are not the primary managers of your healthcare. You are. You are. And somebody said that, a physician said, he said, I like my patients to be assertive with me. not aggressive, not passive, but assertive in the sense of they're taking responsibility for themselves. If I could just again give you one last quote here. This is a physician speaking. It's important that you be assertive with your doctor. Don't worry that this will discomfort her or him. Almost every doctor I query on the subject yearns for patients to be more assertive. A typical opinion is, angry and demanding patients make me react in the opposite way to what they want. And passive, groveling ones, I heard of a man who went into for an evaluation, and the doctor said to him, "What's wrong?" And he said, "You tell me, you're the doctor." I mean, that's ridiculous. It's so groveling and passive. And passive and groveling ones make me just as uncomfortable. It's as if I'm being asked to take on too much. And so what we want to see is that they're partners in the management of our health care, but we're the primary managers. They're there to assist. And don't kind of dump yourself on your physician. You know, this is your problem, okay? It's a problem we are responsibly carrying before God and in support with one another, and they're partners with us. Now, responses. I'm sure there will be several. Or one last thing I want to say. Two last things. Develop a friendship and not an adversarial relationship with your physician. Now, physicians are often under incredible pressure with litigation at this point. Pray for your physician. It struck me the other day when I was thinking about this. You know, as Christians, we pray 3 times a day for our food and rarely ever for our medicine. Isn't that curious? We pray all this prayer that goes into your food. I don't know that food needs the amount of prayer we put into it, but I'm glad we pray and say grace and give thanks for our food. But how many of us pray over our medicine? And somehow we've got this dichotomy, you know, between the supernatural and the natural, where of course all of it is God-given. And if you're taking medication regularly, the best thing you can do is pray over it. If you're seeing a physician, you should pray for him. Yeah, as you go to the office, pray for your therapist and say, "Lord, help him, you know, to know what the best treatment would be. You know, guide his hands, or guide his diagnosis, or guide his opinion of treatment, whatever." Very, very important. They get tired of being technicians and engineers. Okay, they want to relate to you as a person. And lastly here, I've got avoid seeking after miracle cures and fringe medicine. Now, this is important because if you've been chronically ill for a long time, you often exhaust, you know, all the kind of orthodox treatments available, and so more and more you're pushed to the fringe. Now, that's dangerous because there are people out there who want your money, and there are people out there who will advertise everything, anything you want. It will be advertised. And so the more you get kind of pushed out of the mainstream, the more you are vulnerable, very, very vulnerable from a number of aspects. And that's why I always think that if you're in the kind of desperation phase, what you don't need is a physician, you need prayer. Because obviously you're not trusting, you're not resting, you're not dealing with your anxieties. And so I think it's always very, very dangerous, you know, to constantly be seeking. You know, there must be somebody who can. And people all the time come up to me and say, I heard of this surgeon in California, or you know, I know if you flew to the Philippines, that there somebody would fix you. And always somebody will fix you or sell you, you know, something somewhere. But that becomes very, very dangerous. You're very vulnerable when you begin that kind of a journey. And it's best not to. Let's just open it up for some response now. Mark and Dan haven't thrown anything yet, so Joel is glaring at me, all these medical people in the room, but to be affirmative, to say you can do it, you know, to say, you know, don't give up. And sometimes one thing that I've found is that there's a difference between pain and damage. you know, that sometimes you can do something that will cause you, I do a lot of things that cause me pain, but they don't necessarily damage me any further. And so sometimes that's where, for many of us with chronic illnesses, we need to be pushed through the pain barrier. Now, I'm sensitive saying this because it depends on your condition. But I know, like with me, I know that a lot of things I do cause me pain. I would do very, very little, but I know that pain is not damage. Okay, it's not damaging me any further. It's just triggering pain. And so there's a difference between pain and damage. And if you've got a chronic illness, you need to know, you know, when you need to push through the pain, because what you're doing, the positives, the getting on with your life, the not giving up, is worth it. I know some people who have back problems and they still play golf, you know, because their swing is not so, you know, rotated, and they're in terrible pain when they finish, but they've enjoyed it so much and they've not damaged themselves, and that's an important distinction. Yeah, very good point. Very good point. If you love somebody, you can closet them too much, protect them too much, and sometimes we need to be. Jenny is always good at giving me a push. You know, she gives me regular pushes. I was going to say kicks, but I thought that might be whatever. Very important. No, I wasn't. I wasn't denigrating second opinion or the use of vitamins. Nothing like that, that I would almost consider mainstream. It was more that after people have got the second opinion, the third opinion, the fourth opinion, you know, they've explored nutrition, but then they're still not well. And so they continue. There must be something out there. And somebody will always sell you something, you know. And that's when I think it gets dangerous. Not the sound second opinion or the good nutrition, those kind of things at all. Not at all. Yeah.
Maybe I could just add this point, because I thought maybe Ray might say it, but I think it was very important in our case, and it seemed to take us a long time to even realize this, and that's why I'm saying it, because you may not have thought of this, but in Ray's case, and I'm going back maybe 3 years, in Ray's case he has several different sources of pain, and so you've got different doctors. He was seeing different doctors, okay? So he was going to, he had an operation, so that involved the surgeon. He has osteoporosis, so we were seeing the osteoporosis consultant, and then, you know, maybe another one, and then he was going to the pain clinic. So he was kind of going to all these different doctors, quite rightly so, because they were all treating different things. But what we began to realize, it's a little bit about this disease and illness, cure and care, although I'm talking more about the medical side at the moment. But what was starting to happen was, because he had pain for so many years, and I'm sure this is true of many of you, because he had so much pain for so many years, this started to affect his whole system. You know, he couldn't sleep properly, he couldn't eat properly, he couldn't, you know, all other kind of parts of his anatomy was kind of suffering from it. And so, you know, he'd go to the osteoporosis doctor, and she would tell him only about his osteoporosis. And he'd go to the pain clinic, and they talk just about the pain. But in fact, you know, his deterioration was much bigger than that, and no one doctor was kind of addressing that. They kind of weren't looking at him and thinking, "You're in a mess."
I'm still in a mess, but just smiling.
But it was no fault of the individual doctors or clinics. So it wasn't that we were feeling they were bad doctors, but it just was, and I've talked to other people in this situation who felt the same thing. They go to the doctor and they give them the right advice, but somehow they're not really seeing them as a total person and not really seeing what's happening to them over a period of time. And so what we did in our case is we started to realize this, and we actually started to pray that we would find somebody who could kind of look medical, who could kind of see Ray as a whole. And this is really what happened. In fact, one of the doctors I've mentioned, really, they, without us saying to her, she actually was a Christian, but so maybe it was, you know, the Lord showed her, I don't know, but she started to ask questions in these other areas and realized really he wasn't doing very well. And so actually that's indirectly what caused us to come here to Omaha.
Yeah.
Because she said that he should take a whole year off and start to get recovery and start to build back you know, some recovery. So yeah. That's kind of why we ended up here. But what I'm saying is that you're going to the right doctors, but you kind of don't realize this is not all that I need if it's a very long-term chronic thing.
Yeah. And I did have a general physician, a GP as we call them, but I think that he just felt that my situation, you know, was beyond his, you know, his skill level. And so I was involved with different specialists, but none of them kind of were reading me as a person until we hit that, which is very important. Mark?
Oh, I want to just say you are definitely a fullback in the Lord's kingdom, and I feel totally...
I thought you meant I was a fullback and I really didn't have any pain at all. Go and play football, get on with it.
He's definitely a linebacker in the Lord's kingdom, I would say. But as an anesthesiologist, I can relate to what he was saying in terms of hooking people up to machines and all that. But just, they've touched on one thing that's very critical here, and that is it's a very complex issue. And that's why a multidisciplinary approach to this problem is so critical. And I think you've gone through and seen all these specialists and so forth, and everyone's come up with some different ideas and so forth. I think the bottom line is you need somebody to kind of direct the care of the patient.
Right.
And then you need the expertise of a lot of different people, whatever it would be, neurosurgeon, anesthesiologist, whatever, physiatrist, physical therapist, whatever it would take to treat that patient. But you need one person that's kind of a quarterback in the situation to kind of help direct the care.
Yeah.
And we do, as physicians, we you know, kind of nice to go to McDonald's and drive out and be done, you know. I'm getting better at listening. It's difficult, but it's a process. It's a learning process. So.
Well, you know, so many times when you've got a chronic illness, you do, right, each one of these marvelous people give you medications, and so many times these medications work against each other in your body. So again, what Mark is saying is that you need somebody that knows what these drugs are going to do to that body, because that's going to cause you more pain or mental depression or whatever.
Right.
You really have to know what you're putting in that body to be able to feel good by yourself too.
Right. Good. Good. Okay. Joe, would you like to make any comments from where you stand down at your pain clinic? Feel free to use the mic, Joe, if you'd like to.
You mentioned multidisciplinary university. You know, pain center is a multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary pain program. We have been fighting the trend in the delivery of healthcare and also in the reimbursement of it to turn the pain center into the McDonald's of pain. It is contrary. We're getting a lot of resistance from the insurance companies, but we have clung very dearly to the relationship that we have with our customers. As I was sharing with Reverend Mayhew last night, one of our mottos is chronic pain requires chronic care. And so we know that when we start up a relationship with a person, we expect to have a long-term relationship with that person. I know myself as a physical therapist, you know, I've worked in acute care settings, and I'm accustomed to thinking about treating individuals anywhere between 3 to 7 to 10 to 15 at a time. However, at the pain center, I don't do that. And none of us do that. We just treat one person at a time, and we block off time to spend with them. And that's a major shift in the traditional way of providing healthcare. We have no high technology at the pain management center. We have, you know, in a physical therapy mode, we don't have any traction devices, we don't have any ultrasounds, we don't have any electrical stimulators. It's all hands-on education and relationship. We're not expecting cures. A lot of times we have symptoms that do go away, but we don't expect that. That is just a blessing, actually. It's just a gift. When it comes to honoring you as people rather than a disease or are looking at you as a machine. We really try not to do that. And that even is a little difficult in the administration of the hospital,
indeed.
There.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you very much. Good.
Please.
Yes.
It's not like there's a way to get into the office to interview the physician.
Right.
And I remember I had gone to this caregiver and actually interviewed the hospital and the physician, got on the table and realized what he was doing to me. He was using Eastern practices. And
right.
And I mean, you don't have to go through so much. There needs to be a way to interview.
Yes.
Because as they treat the whole person, they're being treated by them as a whole person.
Right.
And where their values and beliefs, that does affect us.
Right.
It's not like they have a brochure, you can sit down and interview them. They don't allow that. You have to go through lots and lots of visits to finally decide this person is not where
right.
I am. And that's a hard piece for the consumer, the customer.
It is.
So I would hope that someday we may develop a way to interview and process before we go through all that.
Yes. Well, the one physician I was reading last week, he, and I don't know how, Doug, you would respond to this, but he actually recommended if you're looking for a general practitioner that you phone them and say, can I buy some of your time? I want to come and talk to you, you know, and he recommended that you do this and you ask them, you know, about their, you know, philosophy of treatment. You get to know them as a little bit as a person. You have to pay for their time, but if that's going to be a long-term relationship, he said, do it. He said, most physicians appreciate that because they want to relate to you as a person, you know, not just, be a technician and an engineer. And he said that in his experience, you know, when people had done that, not in an adversarial way, but to say, I realize your time is valuable, but this is an important relationship to me. I'll pay to come and talk to you for half an hour. You know, I want. And he said that most physicians will respond very warmly to that because they realize that you're taking the relationship seriously. So what you're saying is a very good point. I hadn't noticed John Donovan had crept in over here. John's also a physician. Anything you would like to say, John, at this point?
As a pediatric specialist, I hear a lot of what you're saying, and I would say maybe the pediatricians do have a little bit of an edge in that we do have subspecialty clinics that are manned by a general pediatrician for children with birth defects. And also, I think a number of pediatricians are open to having you come, especially when you're pregnant with your first child, to come in and interview them. At least I believe that's true here in Omaha. And I believe that was true in Tucson, where I trained. But I also think that pediatricians are more relational than the general physician, if I can be so biased.
You can start throwing things in that direction instead of this direction now. Okay. Good. I want to move on. This is a large area. Do feel free in the lunch break to get hold of any of these folks. I know they'd be glad to talk with you. But I want to move on to one other area before we close out here. And I want to talk about the role of the church, in the care of the chronically ill or the disabled. I just want to say five or six things quickly. This is very important. I think I can do it in the 10 minutes that we have. And obviously, the church has been a pioneer in healthcare. If you come to London, you'll have St. Joseph's Hospital, St. Bartholomew's Hospital, St. Mary's Hospital, Methodist Hospital, and that's because the church was a pioneer. The hospice movement was pioneered by the church. The care of the sick in the Middle Ages was pioneered by the church. And so we have a long tradition here. I don't know that we're doing quite so well at the moment in maintaining that, and that's why I want to just say a few things at this point. Number one, we need to promote disability awareness. In this country, if you include those with learning disorders, strokes, deafness, blindness, and so on, there are 35 million people in this nation with some sort of disability. 95% of people with serious disabilities are not involved in any church, often because there are no ramps, you know, no elevators, no people to, and they feel vulnerable to try and go. Only 5%
of churches have any outreach to disabled persons. Only 5%. And so we need to promote disability awareness. Now, what would you think is, after English and Spanish, what do you think is the third most frequently spoken language in this nation? After English and Spanish. American Sign Language for the deaf. It's the third most spoken language in this nation. Amazing, isn't it? Amazing. And so there's often a blindness in the church to a whole sea of need out there. And so number one, we want to promote disability awareness and outreach. Number two, we need to train people, to educate people in relating to the chronically ill. And as I was saying yesterday, people understand it when you're dying. People understand it when you're disabled, if you can't walk or move. It's much harder for them to understand somebody who can walk around and smile and talk and yet is chronically ill. You can't always spot them in a crowd. It's hard for me, looking out on this audience, to know whether you're here as a caregiver or whether you're here because you're ill. It's not always easy to see. And so often you have people in your midst and it's hard to relate to them because they could be very severely ill, but they can walk, they can talk, they can smile, and therefore we need to train people, and that's the reason for this conference, in actually understanding chronic illness. Number three, we need to discover resources. Now we could be on this for all day, but this is just very, very few of the resources out there. I could have put up pages and pages of them, but there are groups, there are Christian groups, there are national groups, international groups that are out there to resource us in caring for those with disabilities or chronic illnesses, all kinds. And I could have put up many, many, many more. And we need to discover them and draw on them. Number four, we need to become advocates for the disabled and the chronically ill. Now, why so few of that 95%, okay, are involved in churches, is because often it's difficult for the disabled or the ill to speak up for themselves. You know, number one, you don't feel good about being ill or disabled. You don't want to make a noise about it. You'd rather sit quietly in the corner. Often you lack the energy to, as it were, argue your cause, you know, that we need a van with a, you know, with a, whatever you call it on it, a lift. We need a van with a lift, or we need a ramp, or we need more care teams, as Paul and Marilyn are putting together. And as the disabled person or the chronically ill person, you know, you don't want to kind of fly the flag for yourself. And that's why it's so wonderful that in this room we have people who are committed to becoming advocates for the chronically ill, the terminally ill, and the disabled. Number five. Learn how to relate. Learn how to relate. It's interesting for me because I've often trained people to go and work in a Muslim country as a Christian, to go and work in a Hindu country as a Christian, and I sit them down and I train them on how to relate because they're going to move cross-culturally. Now, when you begin to relate to somebody with a chronic illness or with a disability, you're kind of relating cross-culturally, because they live in a culture that's very different to yours, okay? Very, very different to yours. And it's kind of scary. I remember Elaine in London who had cerebral palsy. And she was all crippled up and she had to go, she could just about walk like this, but she was in a chair most of the time and she couldn't talk. Well, she could talk, but it was like learning French to understand her. And it took me a long time to realize that Elaine was Elaine. Just as bright as I was, just as intelligent as I was, she just couldn't get it out. She knew exactly what she wanted to say, what she thought, how she felt, but it's a little difficult. And that was a learning experience, because it's kind of scary. You know, it's kind of scary when you meet somebody and, you know, they don't speak properly, you know, or, you know, there's a degree of mental retardation. And it's not easy to throw the bridge. You know, it's the kind of the old story, you know, with blind people, you know, that with a blind person, all you need to do is just touch their elbow. Just touch it with one, and they'll follow you. But usually with a blind person, you're dragging them along as if they're a cripple and an imbecile. You know, it just... I went once to take a service with a group of deaf Christians, and they actually wanted me to dedicate a child, and they had this special. And I was amazed, of course. We came to the singing, and they sang, except nobody made a noise in the room, and they were all singing hymns. I don't know, all, you know, with their sign language, and I thought, This is a world, this is a new world for me. I've never been in this world before. And why I say this is that there's a lot of fear in us. You know, we meet somebody with a degree of mental retardation and we think, you know, they're hardly human, you know, or with cerebral palsy, as if they're just fundamentally different, and they're not. And I was talking with Verlin last night, and Verlin said that from when he was a very small child, his mother and grandmother, you know, they drummed into him. They said, Verlin, you know, you are normal. You know, you're normal. You're Verlin. You're normal. And he said that was so got into his system that he really believes it. And Verlin was saying that if anybody's got a problem with me, it's their problem, not my problem, which is very, very lovely. But we need to cross that bridge. It's not easy. And with people who have like cerebral palsy, they may have a word board and they can't talk, but they'll point to, you know, I need to go to the bathroom, or, you know, I need a drink, or whatever. And you begin to realize that they're people just like me, just with the same appetites, the same aspirations, the same frustrations, often with the same deep love for Jesus as I have. And you begin to cross that barrier. Number six, and then we're going to close in just a moment. Number six, develop a healing ministry. Now, there's a wonderful healing ministry here. In Trinity. If you're not from Trinity and you'd ever like to come on a Wednesday evening, there's prayer for the sick. It can be arranged on other occasions. And every church should have a healing ministry. There are folks here from other churches today, and I do encourage you to encourage your church to start a healing ministry. And I fully believe that there are three channels of healing that are established by God. I fully believe that. I believe the first is the body's own wonderful and marvelous immune system that's laid down 10 trillion fighter cells to ward off everything. And as I was reading Franz Ingefinger of the New England Journal of Medicine, that says 85% of human illnesses are within reach of the body's own healing system. It is marvelous. It is marvelous. That's the first stream. The second stream, I believe, is the medical profession. I believe in the mercy of God. He has raised up people. He has given skills. Chemists have found compounds in the earth that can relieve pain and bring healing. And I believe that there is a rich tradition in the church that the medical world has largely sprung from. Thirdly, a third stream is the healing ministry of the church. And I have no embarrassment whatever, even though I'm sick, of praying for people to be well. Because I know that as a minister, God wants me to do that. God's commanded me to do that. And regularly in this church, I meet people every week in this church who have been healed by Jesus. In answer, I met somebody this morning. Who told me even this morning? Somebody was telling me this morning that they were forgotten who it was. But you could go on. Now, I believe that that is a stream that God has established. And we don't understand why everybody isn't healed. We don't understand why that is so. But we believe that many are, that many are. And therefore, without embarrassment, we offer the ministry of healing to people. And I know here in Trinity, Pastor Murdoch has often differentiated between miracles and healings. In other words, sometimes you pray for somebody and they're instantly healed. I've seen people with cancer instantly healed, and they've been scanned and it's gone after prayer. Other people, it's a little bit like going for physiotherapy. You know, you go sometimes week after week, sometimes month after month, and soaking prayer is like that. You know, we mustn't think because we've prayed once, we've exhausted the ministry of prayer. And we want regularly to offer prayer because we believe it's one of the three streams that God has established to bring healing and wholeness into the earth. So develop a healing ministry. I may have one other, two others, and then we'll close down at this point. We need, as the church, to respond to new diseases. I have a friend in London, and he started one of the, I think in London, the first team for the care of people with AIDS. And they've had a wonderful ministry of compassion. His whole team are Christians, going into sections of London nobody else can access. A lot among people in the theatre, in the arts, who have, and they've seen wonderful, wonderful things happen because they responded quickly to a new disease, as it were. And as Christians, we want to be responsive to what's out there and be there in the name of Jesus to minister. And then finally, and we said this last night, when we can't cure, let's make sure we still care. And what I mean by that is that even in the church, you know, sometimes, you know, we can be praying for somebody to be healed and they get worse and worse and worse and worse. And so we're confused and we back off because we couldn't cure them, as it were, even by prayer. And that's the very point where they need more care than ever. And we began to talk last night, and I will perhaps get to it this afternoon briefly. There comes a point, even in the church, when we need to recognize that people are dying, because we all die, okay? We all die. One out of one dies. And so it's something we're all heading for. And a ministry to the dying can be very, very wonderful. Very, very wonderful. I have friends in London who work in a wonderful, wonderful hospice. It was the first of the recent hospice movements. And their whole lives are involved in preparing people for eternity. And that is no small thing, no small thing. But often we reach a point with some people where there is no cure, and that is where, in Jesus' name, we bring care and comfort and support and compassion. And that is very, very important that we do that. Okay, I'm going to stop at this point.